Hello, and welcome to the Scripts and Scribes live stream Q&A podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Fukunaga. Thanks for joining us on this special Monday edition of Scripts and Scribes Live. Before we get started, our next episode is this Saturday, October 23rd at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. And our guest is going to be screenwriter Chris Sparling, writer of the 2020 Gerard Butler action thriller Greenland. And its upcoming sequel. He also wrote the Ryan Reynolds thriller Buried and the Gus Van Sant film The Sea of Trees, starring Matthew McConaughey and Naomi Watts, so be sure to join us this Saturday. But our guest today is making his glorious return appearance. He is a lit manager and producer at Bellevue Productions, repping a list of top working and up-and-coming screenwriters, filmmakers, and TV writer-producers. He's been a story analyst at CAA, an assistant at the Gotham Group, and was head of the story department at Resolution before being promoted to agent. He also previously ran his own lit management company, Heretic Literary Management, before joining John Zauzerny and the gang at Bellevue. Welcome back to the show, Jeff Portnoy. Welcome back, Jeff.
Thanks, Kevin. Really appreciate it. Glad to be back. Thank you for having me.
No, it's great to have you. We seem to be on the Bellevue train. All of you guys are making appearances. It really is a great company, both in terms of what you've done for your clients, the sort of approachability, the energy you guys have. It seems to be a little bit different than a lot of other management companies and managers that we encounter. So, no, I love talking to you guys.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Yeah, we love writers. That's one thing about us.
Yeah, no, that's what we love to hear. So for those of you in the live stream, please leave your questions for Jeff in the chat and we'll get answers for you as soon as we can. But before we start getting into listener viewer questions, we got some of your background in our intro. But for those audience members who haven't listened to your previous episode, maybe you can just briefly talk about your history and how you sort of got into the industry.
Absolutely. Yeah. The short story on my background is, you know, fell in love with movies at a very young age. I'll give you the beat sheet. Let's put it in the writer parlance. I'm going to have the beat sheet. You know, the beats are, fell in love with movies at a very young age, was obsessed with movies, went to the New York Film Academy. I was 17 years old when I went to the New York Film Academy's two-month, intensive workshop program. That's when I knew I came out of that saying, this is what I want to do with the rest of my life. Got my bachelor's degree in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania in film production, moved out to LA, wrote a script, was an aspiring writer director. When I moved out here, I wrote a script. It made the rounds. It was getting some feedback and the feedback was that it was really bad and that I should consider going back to school. I actually, took that feedback to heart and I went to the UCLA Extension's writing program, film and TV writing program, and when I finished up with that, I started working as a freelance story analyst, reading scripts, writing coverage, and got a job at Creative Artists Agency. And long story short, I was at CAA for probably 5.5 years reading screenplays and writing coverage, and while I was pursuing writing, but a time came that I came to this conclusion that I was better at working with writers than writing myself. And I came to that conclusion because I got a chance or an opportunity to work with some of the CA's clients hand in hand directly, writer clients, giving them feedback, seeing the drafts evolve, seeing their scripts develop. And I really enjoyed that process, that development process. So I got a taste of development at CA and came to the conclusion that I was better at it and enjoyed it more. And once I came to that conclusion, I stopped pursuing writing and I moved into management and production and went to work at the Gotham Group, which was a management production company, got my feet wet in the management world there. And then I went to Resolution, which was like a master's class on representation for me. And when Resolution closed, I had a few writers that I had discovered and brought into Resolution as clients. And I kept working with them as a manager and did a year on my own at Heretic Literary Management, as you mentioned before, and then joined up with John. I've been with John and Bellevue now for 6 years, and that's a total of 7 years total managing, with the year on my own before that. And I was an aspiring writer who came to the log line is I was an aspiring writer who, after doing actually writing myself, came to the conclusion that I didn't quite have the right mentality or components to be a writer, but I really love working with writers and being a creative bouncing board for my clients, and just giving them feedback and helping them develop and helping them make their material as good as it can be. And and then when the script's done, then I put on my my agent hat and what I learned at Resolution and get out there and hustle and try to get them work and try to get them, sell their materials and find them an agent if they don't have one and want one, and get them meet, hook them up with producers and whatnot. So the first part of the equation is developing, and then the next part is actually packaging, selling, getting their, materials produced.
Now, starting off with the development side, how do you find that your screenwriting training, because not every rep studies screenwriting or is experienced at it, but how do you find that your background in screenwriting, both as a writer and having trained, studied screenwriting at taking different courses and things like that, how does that affect you as a lit rep and in terms of
I
your
mean,
development
yeah,
process?
I think having written myself, and I didn't write a lot, I didn't write many scripts. I think it was two scripts total, but just having done it, even writing one script helps you understand how complicated and interconnected the whole thing is. And everything's easier said than done. So when I give a note, I tend to, I know how hard it is to, how everything is interconnected and, the ripple effect and all that stuff. So I think when I'm giving notes, I'm a little more, I understand it's easier said than done. Some people give a note, oh, go change this, and they don't, they forget, or they don't understand how hard it is, how it's going to affect all these other things in the script. And I sometimes will say, this is my note. I'll present the note to the writer, and but then I'll also say, now I understand that's going to affect this, that, and this, and that's going to unravel it, but that's the note. So I under, you know, and I'll, you know, we can talk about it. So I just gives you a better understanding of the whole process. I think writing is a huge helpful thing for a manager. And then also you mentioned just taking courses and classes and, reading books and educating yourself on screenplay structure, is great. It helps me give notes and develop better. Just be, I think it's all comes down to being more articulate. And when you're giving a note, I mean, we all, and anyone can read a script and know if they like it or not. And if they don't like it, they can know what they didn't like or where they didn't like it or what rubbed them the wrong way or where they bumped. But to our verbally or in writing, articulate that note in a way that's like constructive. That's where, if you can take classes and, because that's, it's going to be as clear as possible. If you're vague or ambiguous with your note, then the writer is at a loss. They don't know how to, they won't be able to wrap their head around it. But if you can be very clear and come in. So I think it's, it's all been helpful for sure. It definitely is beneficial to the clients.
And then I also wanted to touch base on the fact that you were an agent and a manager. Not every manager has that sort of background. A lot of them just start off as a manager or a producer or they were former executive. So some do make the jump, but it's not as common as you think. How does that affect you? Because a lot of managers who don't have that background are much more on the development side and then rely more on agents for the sales impetus. How does being a former agent yourself affect the way you operate?
Well, by the way, just to correct, completely correct the record, 100%, is I was at Resolution. I was the head of the story department, and then I was like an agent trainee, and I was on a path to. I think if the company had succeeded, I would have. There was
Sure,
no
okay.
question about it. I would have eventually become an agent, and then brought someone in to replace me as the head of the story department.
Right.
But just to but that doesn't mean that I learned how the agency works and how agents work. And I did have clients, and I was on teams as an agent. I had brought clients into the agency. They signed with other agents, but I was on the team and I was part of every conversation, discussion, meeting. So it wasn't like I just brought them a client. They said thanks and then kicked me out, kicked me out of the door and then just went off with the client. So I got some agency training at Resolution, but I also worked at the Gotham Group. So I got to see kind of each side of the hill I got to be on. And one thing that was very clear to me from having that both of those experiences working at a management company, working with an agency, and ultimately one of the reasons I went more towards management was because there was always, I noticed there was the managers, there was more creative input was more expected and more welcome, whereas agents, it was less expected and less welcome, and less frequently would I see that. I remember, talking to some agents at Resolution, and again, there's exceptions, but I just remember the general vibe was, if the script is ready, if you read something and it's ready to go to market, then, sign the writer and let's go. If it's not, it needs to development, kick that, push that off to outsource that to someone else, give it to a manager, give it to a producer and wait and sit and wait till it's ready. And I never liked that. I remember, an agent saying, I had brought up a script at a meeting that I really liked. And this agent said, is it ready to go to market? Like, could we bring it out tomorrow? And I said, no, it needs work. And he said, then that's not our job. You can give that to someone else. And then when it's ready, we'll go out with it. And I said, yeah, no, I want to be involved with that. I don't want to sit and wait while other people do it. That's when I knew management was for me. Now there are agents that do develop. So just like there's managers who don't develop, mm-hmm. there's the rules and then there's the exception to the rules. So, there's a lot of, I'm not saying all agents are like that. That one in particular agent that I talked to that particular day was like, don't do that. Don't waste your time. That's what he looked at. He looked at it as a waste of time to spend all that time developing. Just let someone else do it. And when it's ready, you just make the phone calls or the emails. And I said, nah, I know what it needs to be better. I want to be part of that process. I want to develop. That's when I kind of knew it was like, if I have to choose, I think management's more my speed, but I happened to be at an agency at that time. So when it closed and I went into management, that was kind of a blessing in disguise. But yeah, I think it's definitely working at an agency has helped me understand how agents think and agencies think. And also it gave me the training because I have clients that don't have agents and I have some clients that do have agents. And in either case, when the script is ready and it's time to go out and sell it and get them work, I have that training and so I can put my hat on and go, let's go, my agency hat and let's go sell it. Let's go get you work. Yeah. Does that answer that question?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it is a different mentality. Even though, like you had mentioned, there's no absolutes in the business. There are some agents who may be more inclined to develop. For the most part, that's not really what they do. Their client list is usually twice as large as a manager's. And so that they don't tend to develop. That's usually in the purview of managers who also sometimes can produce as well because they spend so much time developing things like John and Ian Shore and Infinite and things like that, where he got the rights to the book and that kind of thing. But what I wanted to touch base on specifically, again, because of your agency and management company background, for a lot of emerging writers who may not be as familiar, they just hear agent or they hear manager and they think that your guys are sort of one and the same, they're interchangeable, they may not need both, or maybe they just two of the same thing. Other than the fact that agents tend to be more salespeople and managers tend to be more developmental, what are some of the other differences between an agent and a manager? Like, why would it benefit a writer to have both? And why do managers tend to be the ones that are more receptive than agents in newer clients?
Yeah, well, those are good questions. I would say the reason why it benefits you to have both is you're going from, a good manager is going to, and again, everyone has different, there's different types of managers and everyone has different styles. But I think if you are, especially if you're an individual writer, you do not have a writing partner. The manager is like a private or personal development executive. He's someone that is going to troubleshoot all of the reasons for passing with you. And it takes more time to do that. You know what I'm saying? So like a client sends me a script, we'll hop on a call for an hour or longer. And I will point out things that I think, producers, production company executives, studio executives, network executives are going to pass for, and we'll develop it. We'll address those notes and we'll develop it. And that's a very time consuming thing. And having an agent on my client's team that can help us take the script out when it's ready to sell, it allows me to spend more time more carefully addressing those notes, and it lets their agent spend less time addressing the notes and more time selling it. Now, if they just have me or if they just have the agent, then yes, they're only losing 10% if the project ever sells, but they're putting all that work on one of us. You see what I'm saying? So like you're a screenwriter, you're writing a feature, but you don't want to lose 20%. I can't afford that, or for whatever reason, do not want to have a manager taking 10%, an agent taking 7%. So I'm going to choose one or the other and try to find some kind of hybrid. That's fine. And you can do that. And there are a lot of those situations going on, but that representative is now doing everything. And when you know, say, you know what, let's divide things up. Let's like, Jeff, I want you to focus on the development part of it, and agent, you're going to focus on the sales part and the getting me a job and getting me staff part of it. Then, you know, you're losing 20%, but you're letting us kind of like specialize in those two things, and then we're going to put even more attention towards those things. So you're losing more of a percentage, but you're gaining more in terms of our focus on the work. Now, when the script is ready, we're gonna ask the agent for feedback. I don't want the agent to just mindlessly pick up the phone and just email or call and pitch it and send it out. We want them to read it, and we want them to see if to catch things that we missed, because by the time the script is ready, I'll be too close to it to be objective at that point. So we'll give it to the we want feedback from the agent. We want them to give us their notes, and just like the agent's going to want me as a manager to not just once the writing's done and the script's ready to go and just work on something else with another client, they're going to want my help. Do I know anyone that might be right for this? Who do I know is looking for this type of thing? Maybe I have a better relationship than the agent at a certain company. Maybe I can reach out and make some submissions. So I would say like 75% of what I'm doing is development, and then when the script's ready, 25% of what I'm doing is acting, is being part of my client's agent team. I'm the junior agent on the team helping, and they want that. The agents are inviting that. And the same thing, the agent, 75% of what they're doing is, you know, trying to find jobs, sell the material, but 25% is giving us feedback, and I'm inviting that because we would love another fresh set of eyes on the material. So I feel like it's like a that's the best balance. You want a balance in your team. I don't think you want a manager who's only developing and then when the script's ready, disappears. And you don't want an agent who never gives any notes or feedback and just makes a big list of producers, makes the calls, makes the email submissions, puts you up for jobs. You want them both doing everything. But I think the manager focuses more on that, and having both on your team, it lets us focus a little more, if that makes sense. I've always used an analogy. It's kind of a weird analogy, and I don't know if it's a good analogy, to be honest with you. But it's like, you know, you have your general practitioner, and you go to your doctor, and he or she tells you, you know, you have a problem with your hand, so you've got to go to an orthopedic surgeon. You've got a problem with your skin, you got to see a dermatologist. You got to, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You have, they're just kind of there to kind of like diagnose the general ailment, then they send you to a specialist. You have to have specialists. You don't want one doctor doing every, you don't want your general practitioner to do surgery on your foot. You know what I'm saying? You want to like let us. So I think it's for writers out there that only have one or the other, that agent or manager is effectively doing both jobs. And if they're not doing one of the two jobs, then someone else is, they're not going to get done, or someone else is going to do it. So if you just have an agent and the agent's not developing with you, just making, then you have to find a writer's group or a writing partner or a producer. You need to find someone to help you do that. And if you have a manager who's developing with you, but that's not exposing the material to the town and sending it to producers and doing that, then you've got to do it yourself, or through friends, find a way to do that. Most people that have one or the other, they're doing both jobs, but they're stretching them thin. So if you hire both, it allows us to be more specialized than generalized. That's the way I've always kind of looked at it. I don't know if that makes sense. It's a little confusing, but
No, and most writers, even upper level showrunners, I mean, they have both. I mean, there are fewer older school. I know John August famously came out against managers, I think, but it's more the manager producer sort of conflict. I think that sort of
yeah,
rubbed him
that's
the
a
wrong
whole
way. But
other
also, I
issue.
think if you only have an agent, if you're in the incoming call business, that's probably a little bit easier because you're just fielding calls instead of seeking out work. But for most writers out there who are trying to get their next job, most will have both.
Yeah, I think it's good to have both. I think it's really good to have both, and then they can, you know, you have your, you know, for I the purpose I serve for a lot of my clients is like a surrogate writing partner who doesn't type or take credit. You know, it's like I'm there to bounce ideas off. I'm there to you just I get a text or email me an idea. Hey, you know, we'll hop on a call real quickly. I'm very accessible. It's very creative. It's all, oh, that would be so cool. What if we tried this? What if we did this? And we go back and forth until the thing's ready, and then when the script's ready, you know, we give it to the agent. The agent's going to have notes and, you know, feedback. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't, but we all usually they do, and then I'll be there to help my client address the notes from their agent. And then when the script's ready, I don't just sit back and say, okay, thanks, agent, go do it. I want to be involved. It's my commission as well, and the script's done now. Now the client and I are going to go and start brainstorming new ideas, but until we have a new idea locked down, you know, I want that thing to sell. I'm gonna look at my list, my Rolodex of contacts, and you know, if the agents, if everyone that makes sense for the script, the agents want to send it to, that's fine. But if they want help, I'm there to help. If I have some contacts they don't, I'm gonna send it, and they welcome that. We work together, and I've never, you know, I never discourage an agent from giving us feedback, and you know, for on a script or a pilot or an idea or anything, and they never really discourage me from trying to bring in a commission, try to sell something of our clients, you know, get them staffed or sell something. But the agents are like, it's a bigger mechanism, and they're collecting information about open writing assignments and staffing assignments. You know, so they're aware of those projects. They're spending that time, they're saving, not the 2 hours I'm on a phone call giving notes to the client about their outlines or treatments or scripts. The agents are doing a lot of more networking, and they're doing more, shorter networking calls and meetings and coffees, and they're gathering more information about the jobs that exist, whether it's open writing, open staffing, directing. And then, so they're aware of those things early, and they're, you know, that's what they do more of. So it's just like, I think when I was at Resolution, I got in Gotham, I got to see the two sides and see how they were, the similarities, the differences. And I ultimately, my favorite part is the creative part of it. So that's what led me that way. I think if I really was more interested in the, you know, networking and the social part of getting out there and just networking. And I do a ton of networking, but that part of like, just, you know, having a much higher volume business and it being more about just connecting the dots and finding people jobs, I would have probably went to be an agency. And then there's also differences in the cultures of those two things. There's the management culture, there, the companies tend to be smaller, and the agents, they're much bigger, and there's a little more corporate, and they're, you know, the big agencies, you wear suits, you know, the management companies, you got guys in jeans and girls in jeans, and you know, dressed like, you know, it's not very as formal. So it's a little, makes you feel more creative too. It's just a little different culture. There's the whole poaching thing with like agency culture. You poach clients, managers don't. So there's a cultural differences that also drew me to that side of it. And but yeah, I landed where I belong, definitely on the on the manager side. But I love agents. I have lots of agent friends and clients with agents, and they're extremely helpful in a time, and we live in a time where most of the packaging of, you know, film and TV projects happens outside of a studio or network. And agents and producers and managers kind of, we make that happen. You know, we're packaging it, and then we're bringing the packages, partial or full packages, to the studios and networks and presenting them to them, and they're financing them. So, you know, I would say roughly, I feel like about 80% of everything gets packaged outside. And so you need, agents are more producerial now than they used to be back in the, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s, and into the 80s, even into the 90s, the agents were just identifying jobs and putting people up for jobs. But as the studios and networks started outsourcing the packaging to to us, the managers, agents, and producers, saying, we're not going to do this anymore. It's a time-consuming and expensive process, and we finance production, so why should we have to do this hard and expensive thing? You guys do it. Bring us, do all the hard work and bring us the package. When that started happening, then the agents now take on a producer role. So, you know, there's agents sitting around at meetings at CA and WME who are like acting like producers. Like one agent has a writer client, the other has a director client. They're reading scripts, they're packaging in-house, and then bringing a package to a full package to a network. They have more of a creative fingerprint on that project and on that ultimate film than the studio does. If they're just, studios not, didn't touch it, just writing a check to finance the production of it. They're, you know, so agents are more creative now than ever, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're starting to get a lot of questions here, so let's start rolling into a few of these here. Ash Laser, Gorilla Coast Pictures, good to see you, Ash. Says thanks, Jeff and Kevin. Really appreciate you both taking the time. Let's see, Jacob. Burgos says, hi, had two projects go into development in the last year, one at CBS Studios, the other just sold to Starling Entertainment. Even still, I can't get a manager to look at my material. What can I do?
What's it, what's the name? What's his name? So I could,
Jacob?
Jacob. It's a good question. That's a good question. Had he had, you said he had some things optioned?
It says he had two projects going to development, one at
Going to develop.
CBS, and so I don't know what level of development that Yeah, it's a
actually
good question. I mean, if he's
qualified.
got, if he's, these things are, he's got projects that have been optioned and or purchased and are going into development at major TV studios and networks, then I don't know. He should keep reaching. I have, my gut is telling me he's probably will get signed sooner or later. You just have to reach out to the right people. And, that's one thing I know as a manager who's constantly getting bombarded by unsolicited, queries every day, it's rare to see one by someone who's actually made money, by selling a project to the to a major studio. So that would stand out if I had 10 queries today and one of them said, I just sold a pilot to CBS Studios and I have another one at, Netflix or whatever, I would probably take a look at that. So I think my advice to him is just keep, reaching out to more and more managers. There's a lot out there. There's hundreds of managers and management companies. So just to keep trying. And so I don't have a good answer for that. Why he hasn't been signed, I say keep trying, and my hope is that you will be signed.
Yeah, I mean, if he sold something to CBS or to, I don't know if this company, Starling Entertainment, I don't know them per se, but if he sold some scripts or a pilot or two, you would think there would have to be an agent or an attorney involved.
Just an
So,
attorney. The only thing you need, the only thing you
yeah,
effectively
but
need is an attorney. Yeah.
right, or an agent. I mean, I guess if you don't get your own attorney, maybe. But anyway, that entertainment attorney could reach out to people. I'm sure if it's an
That's
entertainment.
100%. Yeah, I would.
Yeah.
That's a great. That's a great. You actually answered the question better than I did. I think he should reach out to his attorney, whoever did the deal, and
Yeah.
say, do you have, any suggestions for managers that you work with or agents that you work
Because
with? So yeah.
if you got a call from an entertainment attorney, even if you didn't know that entertainment attorney, they said, "I my client just sold a pilot to CBS. Would you be interested in taking a look?" You're probably going to say yes, right?
It happens all the time.
Yeah.
I have, several entertainment attorney friends who call me. What happens? The reason why there's no agent or manager sometimes is because, Jacob may have reached out, acted as his own representative, reached out to some
Sure.
executive at one of these companies and said, "Hey, I have a script." They ex had him sign a waiver, read the script, made an offer, and just told him, "You got to hire an attorney to do this. And if you want to do it right, I mean, you don't have to hire it, to be honest with you. There's no law saying you have to hire an attorney, but if you be smart about it, you need an attorney." And then so you find an attorney who does the deal, takes their commission, and then you should ask the attorney to help you find a manager or agent. And but yeah, that happens to me all the time. I have a man agents, I'm sorry, attorneys who do deals where there's no manager or agent involved, and then they'll reach out to me and say, "Hey, do you know this I did this writer's deal, would you like to take a look?" And I'll jump into it.
Okay, Farzin Farzam. Hi, Kevin and Jeff. Hope you're doing great. We hope you're doing great as well, Farzin. Good to see you. John Lonizak. I hope I said your name correct. John says, "Hi, Jeff. Thanks for doing this. What are you currently looking for?" And follow up: what producers and studios do you have close connections with in developing projects? I think that would probably be a long list. But I guess what are you currently looking for? Are there any particular genres, things that are hot that you favor more than others in particular that you think there's a shortage of in the marketplace or there's a great demand for in the marketplace?
I mean, the usual genres that I'm looking, I guess, are we talking TV or features here? Do we know that? Or
It doesn't specify, so both.
yeah, my our big, my big, the things I'm looking for is, and they've always relatively been like elevated genre. So it's sci-fi, horror, action, but as smart and sophisticated as possible. Prestige is always good. We love our prestige. We love our drama. True stories. So there's no, I like dramedy. We dabble in the comedy space as well, have a little comedy from time to time. The only things that I really don't do a lot in is like family, or I don't have a lot of clients working in the animated family animation space. Some clients in feature animation, but no one in like the TV animated family space. It's a slightly different world. It's like another world to network with. So it's, but yeah, I just, I'm open to pretty much anything. And, there's nothing in no, nothing I'm there. The mandates are kind of always changing, and what everyone's looking for is always changing. So I don't have any set thing. I just send it to me and But yes, definitely for me, it's I do like my sci-fi. I like,
Right.
my thrillers and psychological thrillers and drama, obviously. True story drama is always great.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of his follow-up question, what I will say is, what producers and studios do you have close connections with in developing projects? I think the thing is, when you were on your own at Heretic, it's whatever close connections you had. But the benefit of being part of a company with, five managers is if everyone has different sort of contacts at different companies and you all share those resources, and I think that that's huge. And then also, agents of clients and things like that also have a different network, and it's a huge range of and also because you're at a company like Bellevue and not, your own independent manager, not that, you weren't respected then, but when you're at a company like Bellevue that's respected, you can get into places even if you don't have a specific direct contact firsthand, you make them in those situations and things like that. So
Yeah, it's great. It's what did they call it? What is the Darwinistic theory, the group altruism. It's like you're part of a group, and
right.
if my colleague John Zazerni and Zach Zucker and Kate Sharp, they have three scripts on the blacklist, it elevates our profile, and
Sure.
I might not have anyone on the blacklist that year, but it elevates the profile of the company, which elevates me. So yeah, it's always great to be in a group, and we've had a lot of success lately, and things are great, and yeah, it's been awesome.
Michael Smith says, is now until Christmas a good time to query managers, or is it smarter to wait until the new year?
I think any time. I don't think there's a for querying managers, I don't think there's any ever a bad time. Just because we're the, there's seasons in the industry for doing certain things, and most of those seasons are relate to when you're approaching someone who has money, an entity that has money. So if I'm going to go to a studio or network, to sell something, if a client of mine wants to take out a pitch, a TV pitch or a feature pitch or a feature spec or a TV spec. You want to approach there are seasons and times you want to avoid and times you want to take things out. One of the main things is a lot of these companies have funds that are deplete little by little throughout the year, and then they get replenished at the beginning of the new year. So if you approach them in November or October, November, they've spent a lot of their development money, the money that they've been that's been allocated to them. So the one reason to go out or the first half of the year is because there's more development money in their funds. They don't get them replenished to the beginning, so I'd say end of the year is not a good time. And then there's other reasons why, that are a little too more complicated to get into of why. But for managers, I don't think there's any time. All we're doing is reading and watching things and considering you for a client. I think probably not a great idea to reach out to anyone on an actual holiday or right before a holiday. But aside from a handful of the holidays and holiday weeks. The whole year is game on,
Let's see here. Farzin Farzam got great feedback from working writers on my thriller. Queried Bellevue, didn't get an answer. The subject just got published in The Guardian. It's not like me, but may I hustle and get Jeff to take a look?
I don't know who he queried at Bellevue. It could have been myself, and if it was. I do get a lot of these now. After managing for 7 years, I get, at least 10 a day. I mean, maybe
Sure.
more. It can be 10 a day is probably on the average, and I just don't have time. There's not enough time in the world for me to read all these things. So I do these days. When I first started out, I would read more than, I would read a lot of. I would reach out to people and request their scripts, unsolicited queries. Nowadays, I'm looking for some vetting to happen before I read,
Sure.
meaning like instead of just getting an email, cold email from someone, an attorney, like we mentioned earlier, is reaching out. Hey, I've rep this client did three deals for them. They're looking for a manager, agent, a client of mine making a reference, a creative executive, an executive at a production company, studio, network, or someone like it's just one and it just placed in the nickel or it placed in the, we're looking for that. That narrows the list down. If there's 10,000 scripts and I only have 10 hours to read on the weekend, I can't read all those scripts. What I'm looking for is for someone to vet that for me and say, read these three. Don't read those 10,000, read these three. So I'm looking at Final Draft, Big Break, Austin Film Festival, Nickel, the USC, AFI, USC, UCLA, those programs. getting to the end of the program and getting your master's degree is a type of vetting, if you will. So we're looking, man, I think managers would all agree that we need people to vet for us. You know, we need those, the blacklist website, you know, Coverfly is now a new big vetting source. They go through thousands of scripts and writers, and then they curate it, the list, and email us, hey, these three writers are looking for, you know, representation. They need managers. So yeah, I'm not doing a lot of the unsolicited ones anymore. However, occasionally I will get one, and again, with the vetting will be done in the email itself. That guy that I think it was Jacob was his name, or Joseph, who was emailing
Jacob, yeah.
for Jacob. Hey, I got this. You know, I might have to verify some of that. But if he says I sold the pilot, you know, I sold this pitch, I have this got produced, you know, then he's been vetted before. It's just for whatever reason doesn't have a manager or agent. You know, I'll eventually want to find out why that didn't happen. But it's possible that it wouldn't happen to some. There's a lot of writers out there that are their own representative. They hustle, they get things done, and they, for whatever reason, just, you know, coincidence, they don't have a manager or agent. So, but yeah, vetting is important. So I don't know if it's enough just to have a cool log line or a great script. Just is, you know, just how do you stand out from that, from the other 15 that I'm going to get just today, you know?
But let's say a log line did blow you away, because I've heard from other managers who are like, all that matters is the log line. They don't care about anything else, just a log line. If a log line blows me away, then I'll take a look, whatever. If the log line blew you away, would it being a timely story, like he had mentioned that it was published in The Guardian, not the story itself, but you know, I guess the event that it's based on or subject matter or whatever it happens to be. Would that, the timeliness of it, would that affect your interest at all? Would it move the needle even slightly? Just out of curiosity.
Maybe. I mean, I've got, there's been a, over the years, there's been a few log lines that did, you know, motivate me to request the script, and I did end up signing the writers. It's a couple years, we're a couple years removed from that. I haven't done that recently. But there have been some cases where I saw the log line, and the log line was just really, you know, eye-opening, and just kind of, so there's a, you know, the reading the log line, if a log line blows me away, that might lead to a request of a script. The next step is execution. I've never signed anyone because I've read an awesome log line. The log line has occasionally, if it really stands out, driven me to respond to an unsolicited query and request a script and then give it a read. But the execution then has to be really good, you know what I'm saying? So it's like, it's not enough just to have a great concept, you have to have great execution. And then a lot of those cases when I did request, it was you know, a true story. It was like, you know, a true story, like something like that. When those true stories, that also will help if it's not a true story. So, you know, I lost my thread there. What were we talking about again?
Oh, just whether or not if a log line impressed you, if the fact that it
Oh
was a
yeah, the log
timely
line.
thing would make a difference
Yeah,
at all.
timely. I don't know. You know, if it's timely, it just depends. By the way, writing a script, just because The Guardian published a story about the subject, that's not gonna, the, you know, that's not gonna do anything for me. I have to know what is the log line. I don't care
Oh,
that
sure.
someone published, you know, an article about it. It's gonna be what exactly is the log line itself, and what, you know, and is it a, and if I like the log line, I might request it. But I do, again, it all, everything's, you know, is correlates to how busy a manager is and where they are in their career. Like I said, I'm students for 7 years now, so there was a time where I just, the log line itself, if it really blew me away, I would request the script, and if the execution was decent or great, I would, you know, I would engage. Now I'm looking for that bio to combination. It's a great log line, but you know, if I get an email, it's just a log line, they're including any biographical information, then my assumption is going to be that there is no, they haven't, you know, gone to school, and they haven't studied it and written. I need a little bit of a combo these days. So if I, you know, if they have a great log line about a timely situation that they think will blow my mind, great. But I also want to know, you know, what's your experience? Because that's execution. That's gives me a hint about execution. If I'm getting 20 some queries in a day, and you know, there's all these log lines. If a log line sticks out to me that I think is cool, I'm also going to want bio. Sometimes I will see a log line and I'll email the writer, cool log line, cool concept. Send me your bio. And the bio gives me a glimpse on execution without reading their script. It tells me what I can expect, generally speaking, where it's going to land on the execution, meter. And again, this is all speculative stuff that I'm just trying to judge how I can best use my time. So if someone sends me a list, I was a playwright, I had this play produced, it won this award, and I had this book published, then I go, okay, send me that script, cool log line. And I have a sense that it's going to be at least hit a five on the execution, I just don't have a lot of free time, so I'm trying to be wise with my time.
That makes sense. Tanya Thibodeau asks, can authors of a book reach out to managers or agents for scripts for adaptation consideration? Or is it usually traditionally published books that get considered for adaptation? I'm not 100% sure
Good
if she's
question.
trying to find a screenwriter to adapt her book, or if she's trying to get a script in your hand of an adaptation of her book. I'm not 100% sure there.
I have a sense of I think I know what she's asking. She's yeah, like if she let's just assume for a second she w intends to write the screenplay adaptation of her own book. So she if the book is not published, if a client read I have some clients that write novels and they'll reach out to me with the novel and you can. There is a world where you could go to a production company or studio and send the manuscript and then try to get a use it as a piece of IP to get a script deal where they'll make an offer to the client to write to the writer to write a feature or a pilot based on that. That having been said, it's much easier to do when it's been published because it's been vetted. Just like managers are looking to the Blacklist and to Coverfly and to Nickel and Austin and all the in Final Draft as vetting sources, all of the major streamers are looking towards Random House and Penguin, and they're looking at those places saying, and not just books, but video games and Activision and Blizzard, and the more vetting something gets, they know how to spend their money. So if a book's been published, it's much easier to get to bring in an adaptation deal, an offer to get paid to adapt it, because if I can say this was published by Macmillan, this book was published by Macmillan, it sold this many copies, it has a big fan base, we'll get it. If it hasn't sold to a publisher, it hasn't been vetted yet, it's essentially just a piece of IP, no different from an outline or a treatment. So if I write, it's like taking a script out on pitch. Right now, if I have a client who's developed a pitch and I'm going to go to Warner Brothers or Universal, and they're going to pitch and we're trying to bring in an offer for them to adapt, get paid to write a feature. If they don't have a script, they don't have a script. If it doesn't matter if you use an outline, a treatment, if there's no document exists, or if you have a book, a manuscript, the manuscript is just a more thorough treatment of the story. You still have to produce the script, and no one has vetted it. So it's very similar. If a client comes to me and says, "Hey, I have this idea for a feature. I'd love to take it out as a pitch. By the way, I also wrote a manuscript that this is based on." I'll say like, "Well, you have like, it's basically a pitch. We're taking out a pitch, but instead of having you just do the verbal pitch, we're gonna send the manuscript along. But it's just an additional piece of IP to help convince them to want to do this deal. But it's not been vetted. It's original, meaning it's the most risky prospect that we can put in there, in their court. If it's been vetted by and it's sold 1 million copies, then everything's much easier,
Sure, absolutely. You have a fan base built into that IP too.
So it's like, yeah, risk mitigation is the main, directive of the studio or network exec is risk mitigation. That's why you hear this, everyone wants IP so often, is when you hear that, when you hear someone say everyone wants IP, they're effectively saying everyone wants to mitigate risks. The financiers and those who can afford to finance production want to spending money, they're going to spend millions on something. They want to mitigate risk, and mitigating risk is making have another industry vetted something, and there's a built-in audience that mitigate. Just like with my time, I'm going to re they're they have money to at risk. I have time at risk. So when I'm re going through all those unsolicited emails, I'm trying to mitigate risk. I'm reading, if no one has any bio to speak of, I'm probably going to just delete, the email. But if someone's like, I was a, had an award-winning play and I sold this book, a book, two books published, this less risk for me to, it's less likely that I'm going to waste time by reading that. So, it's all, we're all trying to mitigate risk. If you think about it, just, I have time to, that I'm trying to lo not lose. And the studios and networks have money that they don't want to lose. So we're all guilty of it, in a way.
Yeah, no, and executives and producers is, their job is, executives green light a bad film or two and they're looking for a new job. Ash Laser wanted to echo Michael's question about regarding if now through the end of the year is a good time to query or not. And further, if John Zauzerny mainly handles opening queries first at Bellevue or how that's shared. I guess emailing the info at Bellevue email, the general email, not like an individual email to you particularly. Do you know how that works if John
Yeah,
gets them
John reads
first?
the info at bellevueprods.com. That email, John gets that email, and
Okay.
then I just get my own. If someone emails me, I get it. If they, email
Right.
John,
Does he ever
then
forward
that
anything to
email.
you or pretty much
He does.
he
Yeah, he does. He'll forward them to the whole team from time if he wants. It's,
Oh, I
yeah, he
see.
does forward those to us, and especially if it's addressed to me or my name is referenced, he'll send it to me. And
Gotcha.
even when it's not, he'll say, "Hey, this came in through the general thing," but he gets the email.
Gotcha.
He
Okay.
gets the email initially.
Let's see here. Ash goes on to say, Jeff, thanks again. What are your overall thoughts regarding queries? Besides being short, polite, with an interesting concept, what else makes you request a script? And how many do you request?
Yeah, I think I'd say the best query letters are, and I mean, I think he already knows this because he mentioned all this, but log line is important, but it's not everything. Bio is very important because bio clues us into ex what the where the execution is going to land. Personalized is good. We don't like it when someone says emails themselves, BCCs a million people,
Right.
and it just says hello,
Right.
hello, and then underneath it's a generic email going out. We know it's going out to 1,000 managers, so we just delete it. If it's so, it should say, "Hey, hi Jeff. It's always good to put in a, I heard you on Scripts and Scribes. I saw you on this. You and I know someone." Make it feel personal. Do not make it feel non-personal. Log line is going to be a big part of it, and then bio and keeping it short. And if it's a 2-page, novel or novella, and there's 30 links and it's single space, we're probably not gonna look at it. So if it's just, yeah, and I would say just that's it. That's it, really. That's all I can really say about queries.
Let's see here. How many new clients per year do you on average accept, and what avenue did you find them? And overall thoughts on the Blacklist paid site, contests, and queries. Thanks, Ash Laser.
Yeah, there's no, I don't have any set number of clients that I sign every year. It's all very organic and it's varies from year to year. So it just, whenever it makes sense. So there's no answer for that question. What was the second question?
Your overall thoughts, I think you've expressed it already, sort of on the Blacklist paid site,
Yeah,
contests and queries.
the Blacklist paid website is a one of the preeminent vetting sources that managers use. I know a lot of producers use it to find material to produce, and studios and networks as well. But from a manager's perspective, it has a rating system, and if you got an 8 or 9 or 10, we're more likely to look at it. If it was chosen to be their script of the month or script of the week, we're more likely to look at it. If you got into one of their labs, and then we're more likely to consider you as a client. So it's a great vetting source. It's a great resource and tool. I think it's all writers, especially those living outside of Hollywood. Oh, that's your only, cover fly and blacklist are your only way into, your access to the industry. And I think the blacklist is a little more established, and they have a different resource with the having your scripts analyzed and covered and whatnot. So I think it's great.
Let's see here. Well, actually, I just wanted to piggyback on what Ash had asked. How many clients approximately do you have now? And is it like a sort of a a stasis, unless someone blows you away, you sort of try to keep it within the 15 to 25 range. How does
I
it
see what you're saying.
fluctuate?
Yeah. Do I would I cap? Do I cap the? Is that what the question is? Do I
Yeah,
cap
kind
getting rid
of.
of? Yeah, I never really have ever capped some managers. There's been some times in my 7 years of managing where I've, stopped temporarily, suspended signing, having a baby, moving into a new house, certain things. But it's very, very temporary. It's pretty temporary. And the reason why I always like to leave the door open is just because you never know when you're going to, I have a problem just saying, no, I'm not signing new clients and indefinitely, because you just never know when someone out there, it could be one of my clients reaching out about a friend of theirs, or it could be someone like yourself who read something, and or an agent or a man, an agent. Sometimes other managers send us, we share things, or an attorney. And just because you just never know when you're going to get something that's just going to blow you away and could be a very successful client. So I always want to keep the door open. Now, if I do get that script, that kind of outlier that I'm really excited about, you got to make room. You just have to make room on your plate. And at any given time, having done this for 7 years, at any given time, you're going to have probably, and I think most managers agree, there might be someone that you've had for, 5 years that you've been working with that. Things haven't been working, so you have to, I think you have to manage your list as a if you're being smart and from a business perspective, if you have a client that you've been with you for 5 years and not a penny's come in, and then someone drops something on your desk that blows you away, would it be smart to say, no, I've capped my amount of clients, I can't read this, and no, you have to find room. So if you don't have the room, you have to make the room. You would only make it with someone who you've worked with for many years, and it's just not working out for one reason or another. Creatively, you're not seeing eye to eye. The maybe you're creatively you're seeing eye to eye, but when you're the rest of the town is just not responding to the writing, and you've tried all there is, you're at the end of the road. And in fact, you're doing that client a favor by separating and saying, go find someone else. Maybe I'm the problem. You should find someone else, but and then you make room for the new person. So I'm always doors always open. With the exception of a big life events, the door is always open. I'll always read new clients, and if I find something that I love and I need to make time, there's always a way to find a way to carve out the time. Because at any given time, there's clients that didn't work out that you're still working with. So that's just the reality of the situation. There's always going to be, things like that.
Okay, Michael Smith's, if a client has a script that would be a good fit for a specific actor, how do you as a manager go about trying to attach them? Do you do this before or after a production company is interested in the script?
Yeah, that's a great question. Getting a specific actor attached or a director attached to any given screenplay or teleplay is always two. There's two ways to do it. One is to go to that actor or director's agents or agency, and then the other way is to go to a producer. And now there's been times where I did it in an order where I went to the agencies first and then couldn't struck out there, went to producers. Other times I went to producers first, struck out there, go to the agents. Other times I've done it simultaneously, just giving it, doing it simultaneously. Now, if I reach out to the actors, it also I think depends on the caliber of the actor. Like, is it if you're trying to go for Tom Cruise, it's going to help. Just getting a read from his agent or agents is going to help to have a very formidable A-list producer attached. So for someone at his level, I would say, oh, I'm not even going to bother doing reaching out to CA myself. I'm going to try to get, a major producer attached and have them reach out. So I think it depends on the caliber of the actor and the talent you're trying to go for. I think the best way to do it is to go producers first because it's been vetted. And then so the agents, they're busy, their clients are busy, and they get a call from a production company that has major produce credits, is formidable, and hey, we got this script. Then that's the way that works best. However, I have in recent years gone directly to the agencies, because at any given time, you have clients telling their agents, don't just bring me everything that's already set up with an offer. I want to produce things. I want to be in control of them. I want to do roles that I'm not being, that the studios and networks aren't thinking of me for. And then you have the junior, at any given time, you have these, junior level agents who are job, and they're tasked with finding that material for the client. So you know, a major actor goes into WME or CAA for a meeting or UTA and says, you know, you guys are just sending me this one role. And that's because the networks and the studios are sending you, are reaching out to you with roles for me that are just this. I don't want to do this the rest of my life. I don't want to be pigeonholed. I want to do something a little more prestige or you know, edgy or something. Bring me scripts. I don't care if they're specs. So they have a directive from their client, and the junior most person on that team is going to be tasked with having to do that. You know what I'm saying? So that junior, so that that agent who's the junior most agent on that actor's team or director's team is going to reach out to managers like me, like, hey, do you have anything like, you know, any edgy heist thrillers that are between this much, you know, 5 million and 10 million? And I'll send them something, and they might reach out to that actor or director and say, hey, I found something for you. And you know, they want to make their clients happy. If they just leave it to the incoming calls with offers attached to movies with start dates and all that, then they're just gonna, you know, you're gonna get certain types of roles are gonna come consistently. So I do a little bit of both. It's hard. That's a great question. It's a hard question to answer because I do sometimes do it simultaneously. It's on a case by case basis, but if it's a very high profile actor or director, it's much very helpful to have it vetted by a major production company. But if it's not someone that's not that high level, maybe we'll try to go in. And that, even when they are high level, sometimes the agents, if they like it, the agents like it, they'll show it to their clients and get it done. And I think, again, because the networks and, you know, studios are outsourcing a lot of packaging to the agencies and managers and producers, you're seeing that happen more often than nowadays anyway. So I do a little bit of everything. It's on a case by case basis, but yeah, I've, you know, recently, there's been a few instances recently where I went directly to the agency to get it to a big actor or director. Again, I think it's more effective to have it come from a major production company, but for various reasons, sometimes it does make sense to go directly. I get calls from the agents. Hey, we have this new client we're looking for things for. We want to be make them happy by bringing them material. They've asked us for this. They don't want it to be encumbered. They don't want it to be already set up. They want to choose the director, produce it, and here you go. Here's the script, you know? So.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. You make a great point in terms of is it encumbered? Because, like, having worked on a talent desk at CIA, you get approached all cold queries all the time about, oh, this would be great for Tom Cruise, or this would be great for whatever actor. And if you don't have a hard offer, if you don't have money attached, I mean, he's got a stack that's being sent to him every week of stuff that has hard offers that has money. But what, like you had mentioned, things that they can produce is a whole different animal, right? That's the stuff that they're not getting as much access to. So if you have something that's unencumbered and you come at it from a different perspective, like for producing wise, starring whatever, that's
Yeah,
a
I
whole
mean, by the
different
way,
ball
when you're a
game.
major actor and you get something that's already has three producers attached, set up at Netflix, has a director, the ch chances are you're not the first to get it unless you're Brad Pitt or Tom Cruise. You know, you're the fifth actor on the list. They've got passes from five people. That doesn't make them feel good. That's the first thing. There's no room for you to come on as a producer. If you're not on as a producer, you have little or no control over that project whatsoever. So there's reasons. Yeah, if you hire a development executive to head up your company or a producing partner, and then you tell your agents, bring my producing partner material. We want to get in early. We want to be have a role in developing it. We want to. That's when I, you know, if I become aware that they have a client like that, I'm going to send them scripts to the agents for that. But if the You know, some not every client's not every actor's like that. Some just want if the offer is if it's financed and there's a firm offer and a start date, call me and we'll talk about it. But I'm not gonna I don't care about development or being in control. Just I'll show up on my set and do my part and then leave. Then it's probably better to have a major company come in. Even then, it's hard because it's not already set up with a director and a start date and a firm
Absolutely.
offer.
So Jacob's back, Jacob Burgos. Thanks. I did sell a script, and I have an attorney, Lictor Grossman. They've submitted me to reps, and nothing happened.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, I don't know.
And you know, maybe it's hard to say. Maybe I don't, you know, the particular reps that read it didn't respond to the writing in the way they wanted them to. I can't speak on that because I don't know who it was sent to and I haven't read it myself. All I can say is just keep persevering and keep being persistent and do what you're doing and you know, maybe get it to it just takes time. There's I know for a fact hundreds of managers and management companies, so I doubt he's gotten it to more than half of those. So there's a long way to go, you know, if that's helpful.
Right. And I mean, in addition to his attorneys, the exec who bought the script at the company, the network of the company or the production company, wherever, could also, make some calls if you ask. I'm sure they're a fan, they bought your material, right? So that's another avenue to.
Absolutely. Yeah, the executives who, yeah, the producers or executives who are on the project, attorneys, and it
Yeah.
sounds like he's already doing that and, getting it out to, you can, he should also just cold query more management companies, just volume. It's a volume game, and he's got to find some people that maybe have more bandwidth than I do, that'll take a look at it. So.
Let's see. Ash Laser has another question. Let's see. Some writers think the new packaging system that you touched upon regarding studios being hands-off now is, quote, bad for writers. Any further thoughts regarding the pulse of the writing business?
Well, I wouldn't say it's hand, I didn't say it's hands off. I just said that like there was a shift over, from the, there was a time in this industry where, everything was would be optioned or purchased by a studio.
Right, and
Let's
then
just
they
talk
would.
about features for a minute because it's much simpler.
Right.
Feature script would be optioned or purchased by a major studio, and then it would they would the studio would participate in assigning a producer if they didn't already have a producer. If it already had a producer, they would work with the producer hand in hand to attach directors and attach writers if it needed a rewrite or if it was a book or whatever, and attach, talent, attach actors. The amount of that they were doing, there was a time where about 80 or 90% was all done at the studio would be at the very beginning of that process, and then would it would work out from there, and 10 or 20% would be done outside and be brought to them on a platter with a full, partial or full package. It's been shifting more, and now it's the other way around where most of it's being done outside. They're still doing it. They're just not doing it nearly as much as they used to.
Sure.
They get calls on a daily basis. We have this major actor, this major director. Sometimes it's both the actor and the director. A lot of packaging happens outside the studio, and packages are brought to the studio and/or networks when it's all that work is done. And so over time, and the reason that was done, the reason it shifted from an 80, 80% being done starting with the studio, with the studio's involvement, and 20 being done outside. And now, in my opinion, 20% internally is packaged and 80% is being brought to them without, is because in order for them to package, they have to put money down first. You know what I'm saying? So in the 80s and 90s, they bought hundreds, if not thousands, of spec screenplays for six figure, mid six figures each screenplay. And then they said, okay, now that we have the script, we're gonna take this producer's gonna be, is gonna produce it. And then once that producer's attached, they go out and they let's go out to directors, let's go out to actors. Every once in a while, they weren't able to get a director actor attached. They weren't, which mean the movie didn't get made, and they're out $400,000 or $500,000. And then they would, so now they're saying, you do that, and that's, and we don't spend any money. We don't have to spend any money. You know what I'm saying? You. So it's a, it was a financial choice. It was they after the after it, in my experience or based on my knowledge is after the WGA strike 2007, there was like a lot of auditing was done, and there were other reasons why, but there was a lot of auditing done on how much was spent on development over the course of several decades, in all, leading up to 2007. And it's like we bought, one studio might look, we bought 100 spec screenplays, all for between 200 and 700,000 a piece, and we only made three of them. You know what I'm saying? The reason we only made three of them is because the other, the others we didn't make, we couldn't get the right package to get the green light committee to give it a green light, to get the head of the studio to give it a green light. So what we're going to do is we're going to save all that money, and agents, managers, and producers, you guys can go do that work and bring it to us. And if we say yes, and we're going to buy it, then we go right into a green light and we go make it. If we say no, we're not out 300 to 700,000 per script. So it was just a financial choice they made after blowing millions and hundreds of millions of dollars over many decades. They just said, you know what, if this is an ex why are we spending this money when we're the entity that actually finances production? We don't have to do it. It was just a conclusion that they came to, a financial conclusion they came to over time. If we're paying for the movie, why should we also have to put all this money down to see if we can try to get a package together? Let's let those guys go out and try to get a package together for free. And if they fail, then they fail and the movie never gets made. If they succeed, then we're going into a green light and we're making it. So it's hard to explain, but that's the, I don't, whether that's good or bad for writers, is a whole other conversation. I don't know if that's necessarily true. I do think that it's probably financially worse for them, right? Because the studio, you know, in the 80s, an agent would read a script. Agent and manager would just take the script right into the – they'd make a list of all the 10 studios. They'd go out to over the weekend. There'd be a 3 or 4 offers in on a Monday. They'd close the deal, and that writer would get, you know, $400,000 to purchase that script. Mm-hmm. And then the studio, it was their problem trying to get it greenlit. They'd have to go out and get the producer. They'd have to go get the director and actors. And if they failed, they're out $400,000.
Right.
If they succeeded, great. They move on. But they stopped doing that. So they're not paying that money anymore. They're letting – it's being done for free outside the studio, and they're saving hundreds of millions of dollars on that, not having to do that packaging. And I guess that is bad for a writer from a financial standpoint, because they're not getting that money whether the movie gets made or not, you know. So there is – like I said, there's still – you know, at least 20%, if not more. I mean, again, it's hard to quantify it, but the studios do package things. They do, you know, come up with ideas internally. They might have a staff meeting, and someone proposes remaking a movie that they have from their, well, guess what?
Oh, they're, yeah, I'm sure.
That's their project. The genesis started within the in-house. So they now need to assign a producer on the lot, go get a director, and they're going to be very involved in packaging and putting the packaging together. So I'm not saying they don't do it anymore. It's just that there was a big paradigm shift in how much they were doing, and it all had to do with money.
Mm-hmm. Let's see here. Clint Williams. Hey, Clint. Zoom meetings are now routine. So does that mean feature screenwriters no longer have to live in L.A.? I realize TV writing is a different animal. Thanks.
I would say this. If you have a representative, if you can get your work exposed to producers and buyers and agents and whatnot, you don't need to live in L.A. And if this is pre-pandemic, you do not have to live in Los Angeles to be a creator, meaning write, especially on the feature side, writing something and then just selling it. As long as you have a representative who lives here, getting staffed and getting open writing assignments before the pandemic, you had to live here because that's a social sport. That's in your in-person presence is required for pitching on to get an open writing assignment or getting a job, so to speak, you know? So, now the pandemic came along, and then you didn't have to live here at all to do anything as long as you had a representative. That is going to start to change. It's going to get a little more and more gradually in person, back to in person as time goes on. We're not even close to it being back yet, but maybe sometime next year it'll start to be, time is going to go on. And I would say in a year from today, it'll probably be back, 70 to 80% of the way it was before, where there'll be, if you want to be a staff on a show, you got to live in LA or live wherever the room is. You could be in New York, could be in Canada. You got to live where the room is or fly and live to go to where the room is. But yeah, if you're just writing scripts and the goal is to sell them and then, get them produced and, maybe do a rewrite, you can live anywhere as long as you have a rep here in LA.
Mm-hmm. Let's see here. Drunk Dracula. I love the name. Happy Halloween. Contests. Do winners or finalists get to your desk or catch you or your staff's attention?
Yes, we absolutely, finalists.
Depends on the contest, right?
Depends on the contest and where they're landing in the contest. So, the nickel finalists, I think right now we've got 2 finalists that we're considering to represent. Final Draft Big Break, the top 10 final, winners of the 10 categories and the overall winner, we look at those. Austin, we look at the semifinalists, and the finalists, nickel, we're probably not going to look at the quarterfinalists. There's 500 of them, you know what I'm saying? So it depends, and then there's certain contests, even if you win it, we're not going to look because it's, if it's the, Martha's Vineyard International Screenwriting Competition, I might not care that you won that, you know what I'm saying? No offense, I'm from Massachusetts and I love Martha's Vineyard and Cape Cod. But you know what I'm saying? If it's not South by Southwest or Sundance or one of these, or Nickel, it's got to have a reputable, there are some obscure contests and competitions. And if we haven't heard of it before, we're probably not going to care that you won it.
Right.
The ones we have heard and that are prestigious, we're looking for the, semifinalists maybe, but really it's the finalists and winners.
Michael Smith, if a script doesn't sell and a client wishes to self-produce it, is that something that you as a manager would support? And would you expect to receive a percentage of any profits?
That's a good question. If a script doesn't sell and the writer decides they're going to produce it themselves, And
But I don't know if self-produced means like they want to get a producer to help them raise money, or if they actually are just going to whip out their credit card or have some
yeah, they're
sort of,
self-produced and they're self-financed. Those are two different
Right.
things. If the client is going to self-finance something, then
Then.
I can't imagine we would ask for a commission if they're going to open up their pocket and say, "Hey, I'm going to, pay for the movie." If they reach out to a producer they know, if let's say they write a script and I'm out to 30 producers and we strike out, and then they send it to a producer they know, and that producer ends up, getting it to a major buyer, and that buyer comes in and wants to make it. If we help develop the script, we put up, gave them our time developing it, we gave them our time trying to find buyers for it and producers for it, but we struck out and they found a way to do it. We would still commission that because our time was spent trying to do it, even though their contact maybe ultimately led to the offer that came
Sure.
in. We're going to be involved with, helping them negotiate that deal or furnishing them with an attorney if they don't already have one. And we're going to, we're giving them advice on it. And we obviously did all the work leading up to that point. So I think in that case, we would probably expect commission if we did all the work, but just for whatever reason, and it's happened in the past where, the managers and agents are out to 50 people, and one day the client's like, "Hey, I gave this to my friend, and he, is friends with someone at Netflix, and they're going to make an offer, but we put our time, we're getting paid for our time, not because we brought that one offer in. It's a
Right.
time thing, not a, a per, it's not on an offer by offer basis. It's, and there are a lot of writers out there that think that, like, if someone brings in an offer, they're entitled to commission something, but if they don't bring in the offer, they're not entitled to commission. But that's not how it works. We work on a, it's our time we're getting compensated for, so we would expect in that, but there might be circumstances why we wouldn't. Again, there might be reasons, but that's off the top of my head what I think would happen.
Right. Let's see. Ash asks, you mentioned vetting by Blacklist, Coverfly, etc. So are you regularly reading those lists they say they are sending to reps? Oh, I guess because, like the weekly Blacklist, whatever, highlights.
Yeah, we read those. We're reading the log lines and the bios and the blurbs that we get from Blacklist and Coverfly for sure.
Drunk Dracula's back. In the late 90s, I had a lit agent, some action, etc., but have now jumped back into screenwriting after a 15-year hiatus. I know TV streaming is huge now, but do feature specs have a chance slash audience? I guess in streaming specifically, because obviously features still.
Yeah, the streamers have been the features have, theatrical features have been, the amount of theatrical movies being released every year has been dwindling and, contracting, and it has been for the last at least a decade, if not longer. But guess what? Thanks to streamers, there's been a big proliferation of features that are being released on streamers. They're smaller budgets, most of them, not all of them. Netflix is doing some really big, straight to streaming features, like Project Power and Bright, but yeah, there's so there's there the streamers have been picking up where theatrical is like, where the numbers are low on theatrical, streamers have been, filling the gap. But also because they're streamers, the budgets are a little smaller, but there's still occasionally some big budget. But yeah, I'd say thankfully, because streaming's the reason why there's fewer theatrical films. So, I think it makes sense. They're also the reason why they're going over there. But yeah, the reason people aren't going out to theaters as much is because there's so much premium content at home. And therefore, fewer people going out means the movies have to get bigger, longer, more, event films, and then the smaller things are going to streaming. So there's still a home for all that stuff. It's just not in theaters, unfortunately.
Astrov2 says, I have two managers reading my new feature. How long should I wait to follow up on that read?
2 weeks. 2 weeks is a good amount of time to follow. If you haven't heard back within 2 weeks, I'd say that's a healthy amount of time to follow back up.
Clint Williams, do you automatically delete a query when you read, it's a Western?
No, not necessarily. I Westerns are hard. That's common. You'll hear that around town. Westerns are extremely hard. One second here.
We have a little gap where Jeff is stepped aside. It must be an important client call. So let's see here. I'm going to go through a few.
Sorry about that.
Nah, it's all good. It's all, I was just going to fill the dead air, but now you're back. Let's see here. Ash Laser, in a perfect blue sky moment with a client, what would your ideal script or story be right now? Like, what would be your dream project?
What would be my dream project?
Hmm.
I can't, it's hard to say. I, you know, like I said, something that's really well written that I could, you know, hopefully sell and get. I mean, the dream, the goal is to get things produced,
yeah,
and produce at a high level. So, I love all genres. There's very few genres that I don't like. So I would, you know, open to anything. Love, like I said, I have a soft spot for sci-fi and for, you know, high concept, elevated science fiction,
mm-hmm,
grounded elevated science fiction. So.
Todd Klinger, should a newer writer be focusing on high concept ideas when trying to land representation?
High concept ideas. Yes, I think they should. It's not just high concept ideas. It's two things that they should, when you're trying to get representation, and more important than just trying to get representation, when you're trying to get, you know, discovered in the business and get on the map of, you know, you want to stand out as much as possible. So it's high concept, but it's also bold, loud, buzzy, wild ideas. You know, we call them stunt specs, buzzy stunt specs or voice samples. So when you're trying to get representation and, but more importantly, trying to get, you know, on the radar of producers and agents and studio executives, you want to be bold, think outside the box. High concept falls under that umbrella of, you know, high concept is good for sure. So yes, can't go wrong with high concept.
If a producer reaches out to you looking for something specific, would you ask a current client to try and develop something quickly or search for a new writer with said project via the blacklist, etc.?
Read that one again. I lost that.
Yeah. If a producer reaches out to you looking for something specific, would you ask a current client to try and develop something quickly or search for a new writer with said project via the blacklist? Like, I guess if they're looking for, a bank heist movie, and you would you look up and your none of your clients had one, would you reach out to your clients and say, hey, do you have any ideas for a bank heist movie?
Would
you
want to write one? I would let it go. I would just tell the producer that I didn't have one, and that's that. I'm sorry, I just don't have a thing at this time. Because if I reached out to a client and said, hey, such and so producer called me, he's looking for something specific, by the time the script was ready, that other producer could A, already have found what they were looking for and not have a need anymore, or B, the need has changed and they're not looking at it for that anymore. You know, the average amount of time to get the script done would be 4 to 6 months, right? So I would just say, no, we don't have one. If I ever have one of those in the future, I'll call you. And if you're, you know, you're still interested, sure. But I wouldn't call a client and rush them to write something and chase some kind of, this producer just called me and he had an idea. He thought it would be anything, or he just talked to Netflix and they're looking for things. Let's rush something out quickly to get to them. I would just say it doesn't exist. I wouldn't. And I wouldn't look for one either. I would just look at what I have at that time, what I have or what's about to be finished. I would look at my list of clients, what's available or what's about to be available in the next couple of weeks. And if I have anything that matches, great. If I don't, I would just say no. And then that would be it.
Right. Bravo Sniper 47. What's the average for a spec script with a production budget set at around 5 million? I don't know if he means average page count or average, like sale price for the script, maybe the sale price, because it's usually about 10%, but it depends on, you know, lower the budget, obviously. So I guess maybe we'll go with, what's the average sale price for a spec script that you think for a production that has a production budget around 5 million?
5 million, it's usually 2.5%. The industry standard for a sale price of a screenplay is 2.5% of the overall ingoing budget of the film. So if it's 5 million, it would be 2.5% of that. And that's what we're aiming for as reps. And that's, you know, there's different circumstances and reasons why you might get more or less than that, but that's what we aim for as reps, like agents, managers, and attorneys. That's our goal, is to get you 2.5% of that as a purchase. But if there's competition, you know, and there's heat and there's talent attached, we'll try to get you more. And sometimes when there's no heat and there's no competition, you might get less, you might get 2% or 1%. I can imagine there's been some as low as 1.5%, but 2.5 is what we're aiming for. That's what you should expect and try to strive for.
Yep. So Ashley, thanks again, Jeff and Kevin. This was really fantastic. Really appreciate all your insights and time. Thank you, Ash. Andreas Anderson, I'm making a $6.5 million movie. They want to do at least two more with me, yet I have no one representing me. Is that enough to seek out to you guys?
Say that again. I missed some of the
I
details.
guess this Andreas is making a $6.5 million movie, and they wanted to do two more, but he doesn't have a representative. So is that enough to
Cool.
seek out you guys, or is that enough to, you
It's
know?
not enough. If someone reaches out to us and makes an unsolicited, query and says, I'm trying to make a movie at any given budget, it's not going to move the needle for us. If that money's in the bank, maybe it moves the needle for us because that means they've been vetted. Again, back to that principle, the vetting principle. But it sounds to me like this person's just a writer that has some scripts that have, and they didn't happen to know what the budget is of those scripts. That's not going to move the needle for us. It's going to be the bio, it's going to be log line, and it's going to be vetting from the industry. So this is the log line. This is my bio. I had, this degree. I wrote this, and that. And vetting is part of the bio. It's like, I placed in this competition, won this competition, and I had this produced, and I had this actor star in my last film. This film was actually financed. So that's all that matters to us. But if they're saying that they have no fun, so I'd have to get details what they mean by $6 million if they, if it was
If it's
produced.
actually financed, the deals, are, contracts are signed, they've gotten paid, or they're going to get
In
paid.
which case, why do they need a man? They shot right now, they're doing fine. They just sold something, and if that would help them find one, maybe it might help, It's vetting. Someone writing a check for $6 million is a form of vetting. So if a writer comes to me and says, "Hey, I'm looking for a manager. By the way, this financier just wrote a check for $5 million," I might say, "Okay, well, I might want to check that out because, they saw something in you." But if they're saying to me, "This script would cost $5, $6 million if it were someone were to believe in it," then that isn't to say that I wouldn't read it because again, if I like their bio and I like the log line, I might say, "Let's." My job is to find that person to write the check for $5 or $6 million, but that alone isn't going to do it if it's not. So yeah.
No, that makes sense. Drunk Dracula's back. Let's say you sign me or one of us. What do you and your team want from a client? That's a good question. What's our responsibility to be a good client? I like that question. That's never asked.
The responsibility is to. You should always be sending your reps, your managers, new ideas. Producing, in short, it's producing new material. You have to co consistently be producing new material. And that starts with writing up a list of ideas and sending them to us. And then when we've locked in an idea, writing the first draft, writing the outline, writing a treatment, and then just, making, trying to produce two or three pieces, new pieces of material every year. I mean, so being productive and producing new material—that's the m first and most important thing that you should be doing as a writer who has representation. Listening to your reps. You don't have to. You can push back. You should if there's something you don't love and you a note you've gotten that you don't love or advice. You're welcome. You don't just take it and roll over. You have to. You can. You speak up for yourself. But yeah, I would say producing new material.
And we're starting to run a little short on time, so we do appreciate you coming on. What is some one last piece of advice for those emerging writers out there? What advice would you give them to hopefully make their journey to land representation a little bit easier?
Yeah, I would say the best things you can do as a writer is, it's a couple of things. It's definitely, and I mentioned some of this, I touched on this before, be bold. It's not, when you're trying to break into the industry as a screenwriter, it's not necessarily about writing something that can sell, make money, and get produced. It's about getting noticed as a writer. So you write a stunt spec or a stunt specs are an extreme version of this, but you can write high concept, bold ideas. If we're seeing thousands of log lines a month, you want to stand out from that list. So if I get 1,000 log lines and 800 of them have the word cop in them or FBI agent or you might want to try to move away from that. You might want to try to move away from those things. You want your log lines to stand out. You want to be bold and buzzy and unique. even if you're looking at the logline going, this could never sell because it's too weird, or there's maybe a life rights or music rights component that you don't control the rights to, you know, as long as you're not monetizing it, you can write a script about anything. You're free to write anything as long as you don't make a penny from it. So you can write a script about, you know, someone who's alive and who you don't have their life rights, or as long as there's no money, it's just going to be a sample. You have to be resigned to it just
like
being
Madonna.
So, yeah, like Madonna, exactly. So be bold, stand out from the crowd, and your log lines need to stand out. Your bio should stand out. Get vetted. So it's be bold, then get vetted, which is blacklist. And, you know, we talked about this cover fly and, you know, final draft, and, you know, get vetted as much as possible. Be bold in concept. And then when it comes to your bio, pick the things to put in your bio that make you different, that set you apart from the group. Everyone's gone to college, or it's not everybody, but most people have gone to college, got some kind of degree. They're from some state, you know, pick out the thing that makes you unique. If you, you know, worked at a Jamba Juice as the, you know, guy or girl that got up on and had to lead the chants, you know, they used to sing at Jamba Juice. I'm just thinking off the top of my head, and it's a little zany, but you get what I'm saying. Like, you know, something, you had a crazy, weird, odd job. Like I, you know, used to do this weird, odd job, or I used to, you know, when I was a kid, not a kid, when I was like in college, I, you know, had a summer job where I worked with the Department of Public Works, and we used to do landscaping at the graveyards and the cemeteries in town. And I had to dig the grave every once in a while. We dig graves, you know, the holes for the headstones in the graves, pick that out and say, yeah, hey, I used to be, you know, I worked at a, when I was a teenager, I worked at a cemetery digging graves. I, you know, did this. I had a weird job where I used to, you know, drive around this celebrity or something. It's people want to know what's unique about you. They don't care about the stuff that's, you know, everyone has. If like I have, you know, this degree from this and I did this. So, you know, stand out in your bio, stand out in logline, be bold and get vetted. And that's about, and be your own rep until you have a rep, which is a lot of these people that are texting us today are being their own rep, reaching out to, you know, managers, reaching out to producers. You know, that guy, Joseph, I think his name was, he sold something. He was acting as his own representative until he can find one. He reached out to someone and someone reached out to him and he sold something without having a rep. So you be your own rep. Those are, you know, I think when you break it down, it's like be your own rep, be bold, stand out, get vetted. Those are the big things, you know, and be persistent and keep trying, you know. Don't give up. I know that's cliche.
No, I mean, but it's true. It wouldn't be cliche if it wasn't true, right? Be sure to follow Jeff on Twitter. It's at Jeff_Portnoy. And as a reminder, next week we're back this Saturday, October 23rd at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, for a live stream with writer Q&A with Greenland and Buried screenwriter Chris Sparling. Thank you again for coming on again, Jeff. It's always great.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me, really. Sorry for the technical difficulties earlier, but I appreciate
having
me on the show.
It's all good. And thank you all for joining us today. Have a great week, everyone. Be productive. And we'll see you next time. Thanks.